did not get a hard copy of it. It's now posted back up on the website under LPFM. Although they didn't get a different color on it, so you kind of got to look for it a little bit. But it will connect. We've also added Al's fortified studio equipment list underneath it. Okay, so give everybody a hard copy. It's also now posted on the website, the LPFM website.
And perhaps we don't have enough for everyone to have a copy. So if you are multiple people with the same station, we can just take one to your station.
Where is this link supposed to be?
It is on this page. GRC2014.net, LPFM-track.
This is the web page that you go to that has some of the handouts posted, and we'll have more as the hours go on. So it's, can you read that? Maybe not.
Take it down to the actual web.
Okay, it's grc2014.net/LPFM-track, and from there you can go down here, and Tom's timeline is right here at that link. And studio equipment is right there. And there'll be, I'm going to post some of the ones that I did also here by the end of the day. So that's the place to go to get the handouts. Okay.
All of the presentations? Or all of these presentations?
Some of them. Several.
Hey, Tom, Will?
Yeah. How about if I run down this and you can do the comments to start here, and I'll fill in some of them and start from top of the list.
Okay,
are there any more speakers?
Al's got a separate studio equipment list.
I really did it in the same order, but what you have there is this. James Price and I did a little fellowship here about what to look for and what matters and stuff like that.
Well, how about if we deal with that when we get down to the studio section?
Okay.
That's pretty much what yours is all about.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, you want to start off?
You can go ahead.
Okay, we start off with studio equipment. As Al points out, it may be cheaper if you want to get yourself a local cabinet maker and do it rather than buying commercially built stuff. Otherwise, with the minimum cost category is like used furniture that you pick up at a Goodwill store or something like that seems to fit the bill for your studio. I'm really not a studio person, so that's between Will and Al, I think, to go through that. I'm more of a transmitter and STL type, so I'll let Will and Al go through this stuff.
Al, you want to go for it? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. This is for the hard copy.
You should have the handout. Okay, good. Well, what I've done here is I started out with and I kind of embellished it and thought about it from the viewpoint of more of what might be of interest if you're just getting started, and also the issue of real hardcore community, can we build it, can we make it? Also a reality check on the budget of some of the stations that are being built that might only have $1,000 to build a whole station. Why you can't build a station for going over the list, it's kind of the same list. Furniture, my feeling about furniture is you've got to do that. It's to get your local people to make it. You can buy special furniture, but not only can you do it cheaper if you have your friends do it, it's better. You can custom make it to fit. Carpenters are they love to show off their stuff. One thing I'd buy is the chairs, and get decent chairs because the cheap ones will fall apart. And I've seen them fall apart in just a few months if you get the cheap ones. So you want to get this is the spot to spend money because you're saving money in the long run. Get good quality office chairs. That don't squeak.
And liability.
They'll start to let you know by squeaking, but then they'll fall apart. I've seen them go in just a few months. CD players, they're not that expensive. Even the pro ones are not that expensive. But basically anything will work. The 5-disc models that they sell for home discs, they're what I can have a lot. But one thing to look for when you're looking at CD players is to look to see if they have a wire or a jack on it for remote start. The pro ones have a jack for remote start, one that can start the next one, and stuff like that. Look for that feature. It's worth having in a radio station. Price, $250, good price to pay. They don't vary that much. Turntables. The Technics 1200 turntable is the best turntable ever made. Unfortunately, they don't make them anymore. But fortunately, the reason they don't make them anymore is because Panasonic didn't want to compete against their customers, because Panasonic also made the motors for everybody else. And so most of the direct drive turntables are really the same underneath. But one thing about turntables is you don't want belt drive. You want a direct drive turntable. The belt drive turntables, there's a couple problems. One of them is how slow they start up, and the other problem is how quickly they break. That's about what you'll get on a belt drive. With the direct drive, they start right up. And another thing is, if you want a good quality DJ cartridge in it, you don't want an audiophile cartridge because they'll break. You don't want a ceramic cartridge because they sound like crap. You want a good DJ cartridge, and a couple of brand names, Shure, Stanton, they good stuff. And either of those are fine. But you want to get one that's designed for DJs. They track a little heavier than the audiophile ones. The audiophiles might be upset that you're tracking them at 2 or 3 grams. But that's what you have to do.
What was the turntable you said was the one to use? Was this one the Technics?
Well, the Technics 1200 is the best turntable ever made.
Okay.
And you can still get them online, eBay.
You can still get
eBay.
Them online used, but it seems the used ones are selling for more than they ever sold for, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Have you tried the Stanton ST150 series?
I haven't really tried specifically, yeah. But then that brought up to the next statement that I made,
yeah.
Is that one of the reasons Panasonic has continued them is that the turntable market itself is kind of a niche market, and most of those others have Panasonic motors in them anyway. I mean, Panasonic makes the motors for most of the direct drive turntables. People here don't realize how big a company that is. It's a huge company that makes, and mainly it's an industrial supply company that makes all kinds of stuff for other manufacturers. And So you'll need a preamp for the turntable. $50, the $50 ones, the Rolls preamps work fine. But you need a preamp because the output of a turntable is very low level. You can't feed that into a line input. You need an extra box to go in between. They're all okay. Some people recommend the DJ mixer. I don't. It's an extra box, but some of the club DJ types like to have this DJ mixer with the crossfade and stuff. It's a style issue. I actually prefer having two turntable preamps and having them come up on two faders on the board. But it's a matter of preference. You may like it one way or the other.
And you likely won't need the preamp if you get the right.
Right. You don't need the preamp if you get a DJ mixer because the DJ mixer has the preamp in it.
Some of the turntables also have built-in preamps.
Some of them do, but you got to watch it when they have built-in preamps because not really sure what you're getting. Some of the ones that are sold as being complete with the USB and all that stuff, they have ceramic cartridges in them. Ceramic cartridges, well, basically they sound like crap. They were the ones that were used in the 1995 record players back in the past. But you really want a good quality magnetic DJ cartridge. And you want one that's designed for DJ use. And the DJ cartridges are not cheaper than the audiophile cartridges, but they're heavier duty. It's kind of a compromise between sound quality and ruggedness.
Another thing with the DJ cartridges is, and this would be if you also had a DJ mixer, but folks who are doing hip hop or dance or kind of that kind of music doing music with the DJ mixer might also be scratching, which would necessitate the correct kind of cartridge so that you don't ruin the records.
So you don't ruin your cartridge or the records, yeah. You got to watch that. And also, I mentioned it here, you should avoid the straight tone arm that the scratchers want. You want one of the curved tone arms. Now, it's got to be careful when I say that because what looks like a straight tone arm with an angled head is a curved tone arm. You want the angled head. They sound better. The reason they go for the straight tone arms for DJ is it has to do with the scratching and back cueing. But you're going to be doing back cueing, but you're not going to be doing it so aggressively like the scratchers. And so they're willing to trade off sound quality and record wear for the ability to handle this abuse. Cassette deck, not worth spending money on. Get something that somebody donates. Standalone recorder. Generally in the studio, what I recommend is having a computer in the studio that's configured as your studio computer that runs the automation and it has a bunch of stuff including recording on it. The system works out very well. But if you want a standalone recorder, I think that one recommends a $500 model. What I recommend is a $100 Zoom. Now, the Zoom recorders work great. Several of them to carry out in the field, and they're cheap. They work. They're great devices. And the next thing on the list is the computer. Computer runs the studio. You're going to want something that we'll talk about later. And in fact, since we're talking about the studio, I'm going over it quickly. I'm going to be having a session where over in the KHOI studio, where we'll be talking about studio design. And there will also be a session on automation, which is really where we'll be talking about that side and doing that kind of as a team thing. And I recommend going to both of those sessions if you want to know more about it. But a comment about the computer. What I recommend is a Linux computer running all free software. You look at some of the lists and they'll say, software, $3,000. Yeah, you can spend $3,000 for the ENCO automation system. But why? When more of your peers are using Ribbondale, which is free, and actually works just as well. So what I like to set up is a Linux computer with Ribbondale automation system and a bunch of the Linux applications. There's something called ALSA Player, which is like a iTunes for Windows, or an iTunes for Linux, sorry, and web browsers and stuff like that. And the way I like to set them up is to have
maybe two or more faders on the board for the computer, so that you get the automation on one fader, you got the computer playing from the web on another computer, and so you can do queuing and do a lot of stuff. And the computer does a lot. The computer has the can have the automation system, the playing off the web. It can have the your means of transmitter control. It can run streaming software, which can do your own audio over IP system. You can do a lot with the computer. And if you go with a Linux system, it's free software and it's extendable. You get to share with your peers. And another thing that people tend to forget on the computers is you might be thinking one studio. You shouldn't be thinking one studio. You should be thinking two. And you also need to think about the office. And then you also need to think about remotes. And you need to think about the computer that you're going to have at the transmitter site. Before that, before too long, you're up to a bunch of computers. And once you get up to that, you say, well, see, $3,000 times three, that's $9,000. So the idea of the Windows system being so familiar, the people who are familiar with it might be familiar with running it at home. It's nothing like running it in a network in an enterprise situation. And you have to think about this as an enterprise situation where you're going to have a bunch of computers on a network, and you need somebody that knows computers to set up your system. Anyway, you might as well get a system that people who know how to run computers like to use, as opposed to like a Windows system, which is designed for people who are not knowledgeable. I just talked about software. Look for free open source. The whole free open source software culture is a mirror of community radio. It works the same way with the same funding issues, the same political issues, the same personality issues all along the board. It's a mirror. The two are mirrors of each other. It's really amazing how close they are. And one thing that the two have in common is that they don't recognize each other. That goes both ways. I happen to be very much affiliated with free software. I have some projects I developed, so I know. Moving on. The sound card. You know, computers come with a sound system on the motherboard. Sometimes it's adequate, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you want to have a couple more. You can get by with the cheap sound card, but maybe you don't want to. What you get for $100, as opposed to the $20 sound card, is that the cheap sound card generally is designed for ultra low levels. You'll overdrive it. You have to be very careful with them. You can make them sound decent if you try, but you have to mess with them. If you spend the money on a good sound card, and I'm not picking brands here, but if you spend the money on a good sound card, you get good solid filters, good solid levels, good audio quality. And it's probably worth it to get a good sound card for your main output.
What would be some good brands? Because now that I don't know where to start.
I got
Focusrite on this list that's up here.
Yeah.
It's 150, and it's also got XMR input.
See, that's what you get for that kind of price. Is that if you go with the $20 when you get these little 8-inch jacks, you go with the $150 Focusrite, you're going to get real line-level XLR inputs. Now, some people will try to sell you a little buffer box to put with your... Well, why buy the buffer box? Just buy a better sound card.
Well, one of the reasons, I think, though, is also that there's been, with the sort of home recording becoming more prevalent, there's a lot more options with USB and FireWire and other sort of external options.
Well, yeah, you can get a USB sound card. All I'm saying is that, pointing out that you find a range of price, and I'm trying to give some idea of why might you want to spend the extra money on the better one.
And one thing that I would suggest is if you're in a pinch, don't be shy about using the motherboard sound card for output.
Yeah, true. It's usually the input, the recording side, that varies so much in quality.
Yeah.
The only thing, the downside of the motherboard sound card for output is generally that the level is very low. And so you're going to have to crank up the level in the trim pots on your board to compensate for it. But, hey, crank up the level in the trim pots on your board. That's what they're there for. But for recording, some of them really skimp on the recording side. And
And you'll hear, some of them don't have good filters, and you'll hear what they call aliasing, if there's any high-frequency crap that gets in there. Aliasing is, well, high-frequency crap gets in, and it changes the frequency to a frequency that you can hear, and it just makes it sound like crap. And that's something that you get with some of the cheap ones, is they don't have good filters, and that's really why they don't sound good in the recording side. But like Paul says, for playback, you can get by cheap. If it's for the Q channel, you certainly get by cheap. It's the one that you use for recording that you want to upgrade a bit. The one that you use for recording, or the one that you use for your to source your web stream and that type of thing. Sound cards. So, all right, microphones. The quality of your microphone is really going to make a difference in the quality of the sound of the station. You're using it all the time. But let's turn that around and say there's a certain point that you want to be. If you're lower than that, it's going to sound like crap. If you're better than that, yeah, it might sound better to a perfectionist, but nobody's going to notice. And so I believe, seat of the pants, that the magic number for a mic is about $100. That you can spend $300 on a microphone, but you're better off buying three of the $100 microphones. You can spend $30 on a microphone, not likely to sound that great. These the ones that I mentioned here, the Shure SM58 is very popular, very well liked. They sound good. It's $100. I can recommend it.
Now, we have a bunch of SM57s. I mean, is there going to be some notable?
I don't know the numbers, but one thing about microphones is that, I mean, Shure is the names I mentioned here. Shure, Electro Voice, they've been around for years and years. They make good stuff.
The 57 is the exact same mic as the 58 without the additional pop filter.
Okay.
So you need to get a pop filter.
But they make mics that are optimized for different things. They'll make some that are optimized for close speaking, some that are optimized for farther away, and all kinds of stuff like that. And if you're a perfectionist trying to do music recording and you want it to sound just right, it'll make a difference. You'll notice it. But if you're just using it for your announcer's mic and stuff like that, a lot of times you just go to a different mic and most of the time people won't even notice it. You need something decent here, but it doesn't have to be exotic, is basically what I'm getting at. And if you go with any of these brands around $100, you'll be okay. And these brands that I mentioned, they're all good. And I don't have a preference of one over the other, but they've all been in existence for many years, and they're all good. Mic stands and booms, you're going to need something you can look at over in the studio is they have little rubber band things to shock mount the mic so that when you bump on the table, it doesn't go boom boom on the air. Getting on. Okay, your console, mixing board. I've seen everything from, alright, I list here price range $100 to $100,000. I'm not kidding. Reasonable price range $1,000 to $4,000. The particular board that KHOI used on the air was about $6,000. You can go digital if you like. Digital will cost you more money. You figure that you'll start around $6,000. I have to admit I'm biased here. I'm selling boards. I have them on display. You can take a look. We can talk about it later. And mine, as kits, sold as kits, generally go in the $1,000 to $3,000 figure target of about $2,000. But generally here, to give you an idea of what the differences are, if you can get on the air with a Behringer, with a $100 Behringer mixer. It'll get you on the air. It's not going to be what you're going to want to use long term, but you can do it. You can get on the air. You can a $200-$300 Behringer mixer will be better. But really, it's good to have a real broadcast mixer. And it's good to think of two of them, one for your main studio, one for your production studio. Maybe not both right up front, but you want a real broadcast mixer. The real broadcast mixer is simpler. If you have a bunch of controls like EQ and stuff, people are going to screw with it. They're going to mess it up. You get somebody screwing with it, the DJ leaves, somebody else comes in, and they leave it in some who knows what setup, and the next guy comes in, doesn't know what it is, how it's set. So it sounds bad just because the guy before screwed with the settings. So you really want something. One thing about the broadcast boards is they're simple and they're rugged, and they tend to have things like Q. There'll be a Q button there so that you can pre-listen to something without putting it on the air. There'll be a provision where when you turn the mic on, the speaker's mute. That's a standard feature in a real broadcast board. It's not. You may not get this in a board that's designed for bands. I'm going to say real VU meters, but having said that, I have to admit that some of the LED ones do qualify as real. Although I tend to prefer the old mechanical meters, still, you want a good solid level indicator. I've seen some of the cheaper boards that have a row of three LEDs as the level indicator. That's not adequate. You need something with a good solid scale that you can see and you can understand. That you want the meter somewhere in the middle. That's basically the features that you're looking for.
What's your brand name?
Cat's Kit.
Okay.
As in from the Catskill Mountains of New York. Yes,
sir. Yeah. Well, if I could reinforce this, this took me a real long time to understand, but what the weird thing about mixing boards is that you pay more money to have less buttons. On the board. Well, not with yours, but the thing about the mass-produced mixing boards is, like, they sell millions of them every year.
That's right.
And so they put a million buttons on them so they can do any kind of weird thing.
It isn't so much a million buttons, it's a million knobs and stuff like that. But yes, that's the point. Is the mass market boards, they sell a lot of them. They're produced by machine in quantity. Real broadcast equipment is expensive. And one of the reasons it's expensive is because they don't make very many of them. And since they don't make very many of them, the price per unit for manufacturing it goes up. That's why I chose the kit model for building, because no way would a kit be successful in the mass market. It's only when you have a small market. That can be deceiving, that the real broadcast boards actually have fewer things on them than the cheap ones. And the quality of the switches, the quality of the controls makes a big difference. And if you buy a real broadcast board, you're going to get better quality stuff. It'll hold up. That's the point.
Yeah, that's a point that I wanted to tag on to. CD players and boards especially, is they will break. And so, you know, get something you can fix, preferably fast.
Well, certain things like CD players, you get a few extras.
Right.
And going back to the CD player, you can buy it where you have two slots in a single deck, and comes out that and say, wow, I can save money by buying two in one. Well, if you do that and one of them craps out, in effect, both of them have crapped out. So that's not a good idea. Well, it might be a good idea to buy two of those, and so now you have four CD players, yeah, in effect, in two boxes, so you still have a spare. But you got to think about having a spare. I've listed a few of the possibilities of consoles to buy at different prices. Another thing you want here is balanced inputs and outputs, balanced audio, not RCA jacks. Avoid RCA jacks. Now, what is balanced? What does that mean? Standard home audio cable, you got the wire in the middle and you got the shield. And one side is grounded. Well, the problem with that is that if there's noise around, it tends to be susceptible to picking up noise. What they do with balanced is instead of having one audio feed, we're going to have two, and I'm going to feed it these two wires equal and opposite. So there's the plus polarity one and the minus polarity audio line, and they're covered in the same shield and they're twisted together. And so that's at the feed end where I'm generating it. Now at the other end, I'm going to have what they call a differential amplifier. The differential amplifier, instead of just looking at this one or that one, it specifically looks at the difference between the two. And so the reason for doing that is that if there's noise, it tends to be the same on both of them. And so if I take, let's say that it's, right now it's 1 volt. And that means if I have two wires, I have plus 1 volt and minus 1 volt, right? And if I take the difference between them, that's 2 volts, right? Well, if I add noise to that, let's say I'm going to add 1 volt of noise. So I'm going to add plus 1 volt to this line, I'm going to add plus 1 volt to the other line. So the 1 volt plus 1 volt is now 2 volts. Minus 1 volt plus 1 volt is now 0 volts. But I still have 2 volts between them. And I haven't changed the signal that actually gets to the other end. So that's the idea of a balanced line. And so generally you want to run your studio audio in this balanced form so that it minimizes the noise. And consumer stuff tends to be unbalanced. They use the RCA plugs and stuff like that. You really want to try to stay away from them in the studio. You can't completely, but try. And that'll keep your noise down. And keeping the noise down is, noise, buzzes, hums, clicks, pops, that kind of noise. And keeping that down is really going to help in terms of making the studio work better. Does that make sense? You like? Okay, good. The EAS, Emergency Alert System Decoder, I put it here because they did. I don't normally think of it as part of the studio, but they put it in the studio. One thing about this emergency alert system, it's one of those unfunded mandates that the government says you have to have one. And what I've seen is that there are three brands of them that are sensible choices. There's a couple others that are not sensible choices. The three brands that are sensible choices are Sage, Vastek, and Trilithic. And the Trilithic is the nicest of the bunch, and it's more expensive. And most of the time in here, you don't want to spend the extra money, so that leaves the other two. And some people like one, some people like the other. I personally like the Vastek better, and I'm willing to pay a little more for it. But considering that they have the LPFM model, I don't think it actually costs any more. But there are relative merits of the two, but you're not going to change much on the price. It's going to be close to $3,000 for the emergency alert system. And you're not going to change that in the price. You're stuck. Nothing you can do about it. Because here's a case where you have a product that is a mandate. You have to have it. It's a broadcast thing, so it's made in relatively small volume. Therefore, it's a captive market. They can jack the price up, and not much to do there. FM monitor tuner. You want to be able to listen to your station off the air. Yeah.
Before the EAS, I noticed on the grassroots radio list there was some discussion about somebody trying to do a software-based one, and
that might have been me quite some time ago.
Well, there was one since you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I tried contacting him, and he didn't respond to my email. And I was kind of hoping he would, because I would say thank you for doing it, because I'm not. At this point, you know, it's one of these wishful thinking things. I looked into what it would take, and it's not that much. But we can talk about it more later, but basically...
yeah, it was kind of a stopper in what legal coverage. And so the question
is, it's kind of a stopper in the legal side that it has to be FCC approved. And also, one thing that one reality is that you guys are building now, and you need to have it. And if I say, okay, I'm going to set out to develop it, and I believe it's going to take me a year to get to it. Doesn't always go so well. Maybe it takes 2 years. And And so in the meantime, you need to get on the air. What are you going to do? You're going to buy something that's already there that you can buy. And when I put out the feelers for it initially, I basically was trying to evaluate, should I undertake this project? And at that point, based on the response I got, decided not to, because of my estimate of how much work it's going to be, and that I would expect to be able to get so much in financial support in order to do it, and okay, where's the money going to come from? We can talk about this some other time.
I've got something I want to dump in here. If we can back up just a little bit.
Yeah.
If you buy one of the EAS receivers or one of the EAS units that does not come with receivers, I just want to caution everybody, don't take a consumer tuner or receiver and try to feed it into it, because you can knock them off channel real easily.
Well, the story there is, yes, you can knock them off channel, but also a lot of the consumer ones that have that you punch up the frequencies, and then if they lose, you turn them off, they remember the frequencies. But if you unplug it, they lose power, it loses all its presets. And so now you got to go in there and reprogram it. And you want something that's just going to sit there and work. And those Dayton receivers, they work.
And they stay on channel.
They work, they stay on channel. You have to take the cover off so that they're relatively tamper-proof. You take the cover off, and there's little dip switches in there that you set the channel to, and then you put the cover back on. And it might seem a little strange in a consumer world where they say, do not remove the cover, no user serviceable parts, but no, you take the cover off, and you see the circuit board, you program it, you put the cover back on. That's the way they're designed to work. And a lot of times in broadcast, that's what you want. You put the cover back on, it's protected, so you don't have everybody coming in there and
We're going to have to move along a little bit quicker here. We have a lot of information to cover after you get done with studio.
Okay.
A note here. Since Al is doing another workshop on automation on Sunday, we don't need to do that today, and that will buy us 15 more minutes.
Let's see. The speakers and amps. You can buy speakers. You want something that's going to last. What I like is car radio speakers. They're decent quality. They're consumer products. They're made in volume. And people blast their radios in their cars, and so they can take the abuse. I don't recommend the speakers that come with a $49.95 stereo that you'd buy at Walmart. They won't last. But the car radio speakers work great, and there's several brands of good monitor amps. I kind of like that ARC amp because it has balanced inputs. Real nice for studio. Headphones. Headphones break. I particularly like the Tascam headphones. There's a lot of people selling the Sennheisers. The Sennheisers sound nice, but they feel kind of flimsy to me. I think the Tascams are... They sound good too. They're about the same price, and they seem to be more solid. But you're going to need a bunch of headphones, and you're going to need to plan on replacing them often. So you buy a set of headphones this year, you can plan on buying another batch next year. Headphone amps, there's quite a few of them in the $50 range that work good. Another item listed here is a distribution amp. Now, the idea of a distribution amp, you see it on the list, and I think they have one there for about $500. You can get it for a lot less. But you might be asking, what is this and why do I need one? And the reason you need one is, let's think about, I have the output of my board, and I'm going to be feeding my on-the-air feed, I'm going to be feeding my recording device, I'm going to be feeding a line that feeds out to the speaker in the bathroom and all that stuff, and so you just hook them all in parallel, right? Well, what happens if you hook them all in parallel is that somebody screws with one of them and takes you off the air. And so the idea of a distribution app is that it isolates all that stuff so that the various things that it feeds doesn't mess with each other. Telephone, hybrid. Go cheaper, go good. There seems to be there's the less than $100 model that works. There's the $300 model that works. But then there's the $500 model that works really good. So you spend a little extra, you might just get frills. You spend a little more extra, you might get one that actually works better. It's actually worth the extra money to have a digital hybrid. They work better.
What is that exactly?
A hybrid is the device for putting your phone on the air. And what it has to do is the phone has the audio going in both directions on a single line. And the hybrid splits it into audio going in and audio going out. And so the audio going in goes into one of the faders. The audio going out comes from the board, something they call a mix minus on the board. Mix minus means you don't send it back to itself, and because otherwise you get feedback and other devices. But the hybrid is a device for connecting to the telephone. You get a good digital one, they really do sound better. But if you're on a tight budget, the cheap analog one will get you on the air. On-air light and relay. Okay, wiring. I'll just say something about the wiring, and then I'm done. The wiring of a studio can be quite substantial. It'll take you some time, and it's the kind of thing that it's this 20-cent connector and that 20-cent thing, they all add up. That's all these 20-cent things can add up to a couple $100. Don't forget. I actually like what they call the Studio Hub system, where they do it with essentially shielded Cat 5 cables with what looks like Ethernet connectors, so that they get the left and right balance on a single connector. And a lot of the newer equipment is going that way, is using it as standard. And you can make your cables and save some money, or you can go to Radio Systems and buy the cables pre-made. And that's one of the things I like about it, is that you can go, if you want to buy all pre-made cables with all the adapters, you can actually do it. They make some pretty nice stuff. But you got to figure, you could end up with $500 for wire. So that's my spiel. And any questions?
There will be time at the last session this afternoon for questions. So if something comes up in your mind between now and then, there will be time. But let's move on to Tom.
Michael, why don't you take the transmitter section were there enough for you to jump in?
Was there anyone hand up?
Yeah, I got it.
We
got two.
Okay, well, one of the transmitters. As we talked about, the transmitters need to be type certified, and so there's only a limited number that are doing that. The two transmitters we've worked with most often lately are the Nautel VS300, which is a 300 watt, anything up to 300 watt, and the BW Broadcast, which makes several different levels. They're LPFM certified, I think, at their 150 and 300 watt level, as I recall.
50 and 300.
50 and 300, okay.
Yeah, I got another one.
And there are samples of those out, all of those out there. The reason we like these is the Nautel has all the bells and whistles, and for a little bit more money, they will include an excellent Orband audio processor built in. The BW Broadcast is a couple of $1,000s less. Also has a standard, always included, 4-band audio processor. Maybe just a cut below in quality from the Orband, but still quite usable. And of the low-cost transmitters, we've yet to find anything that's better. We don't work for them, so we're not getting any commissions or anything, but there are several others out there, but these are the ones we work with most often, and they're all represented out there. Most of your other transmitters are not going to have a full-blown audio processor built in. So you got whatever the cost may be, you have to build that cost into it. And usually external audio processors designed for broadcast use that are going to do the job properly for you are going to cost you at least $1,500. And so you save actually a lot of money by just getting a transmitter with it built in. And that's basically it. Almost none of the used transmitters out there that you might be able to get, in some cases for no money, are going to be LPFM certified. So if you want to take that risk, you do it at your own risk.
And both of these transmitters have a USB slot on them where you can actually, the Nautel I know for sure you can put a Dave with the programming on it and a memory stick just by plugging it into if you happen to lose your studio to transmitter link or something like that.
It can automatically switch to the
right stick. Exactly.
It has a built-in rudimentary automation system built right into the transmitter. You could run your whole radio station from that permanently if you wanted to.
In fact, KHOI did that for their first, 11 months, I think. They had a lot of trouble getting their STL working.
So did WSPI.
What?
So did WSPI.
Okay, next category is antennas we have on here. And we're talking about the OMB MP1. You want to go with that?
The antennas?
Yeah.
That's where into antennas. Well, we have some pictures of antennas.
You can talk on the pictures.
Okay.
I'll talk about them. And the
transmitter. Yeah. Oh, no, it's. Well, most of the FM. Okay, first about terminology. Omnidirectional. Most of you, with the exception of Detroit, I think everybody else is going to be using an omnidirectional antenna, which at least in theory radiates equally in all directions horizontally. And you'll probably want to use what's called circular or dual polarization, in which you're putting an equal amount of power in the vertical polarization and the horizontal polarization. The horizontal is, the vertical is mostly for car radios and boom boxes with whip antennas, and horizontal is for everything else. It's generally accepted that in most cases you're best off with having an antenna that gives you both of those, although you don't have to. You can choose to do one or the other or both. So you can have up to 100 watts horizontal or whatever your power may be, up to 100 watts vertical. So of the conventional side-mounted, omnidirectional, circularly polarized antennas, most of them can be divided into categories of a ring stub design, and here's an example of that, or a rototiller, which is the next one you saw there, which is probably the best design of all, and I can talk about, and then the so-called double V, flying V, or Jampro calls it their penetrator antenna.
There's another picture of that.
Yeah. Now this particular design, that double V design, is by far the most common FM antenna design in the world. There's probably a dozen or more well-known and probably dozens of not-so-well-known manufacturers that make knockoffs of this. It's so popular because it just plain works well. It's relatively inexpensive, mid-priced, I'd say, and holds up reasonably well if you have a light amount of icing or frost on it without having any radome cover over it. And they just plain work. The ring stub design, if you want to go back to that, the rototiller, the ring stub designs, you can get these for as little as $250 a bay new. You can't get a double D design that inexpensively. So
here's bay.
And then the rototiller design is going to be your most expensive and also is probably going to perform the best as far as bandwidth and antenna match and performance in icing conditions. If you have anything more than just a light amount of icing, you really should go with a radome cover. And some of the low-end antennas don't even have that option. So what we generally recommend for most LPFMs is to go with the double V design. And there's, like I said, a bunch of, at least a half a dozen domestic manufacturers that make that and any number of offshore manufacturers.
Yeah.
talk about cost of a different type versus the one we have on this list here, which is only $350.
The ring stuff, yeah, you can get it for as little as $250, $300. The double D designs usually start at about $700 per bay. And the rototillers, I think you're going to spend well over $1,500 per bay for even the smallest one. With these, if you have more than one antenna bay, and all of these low-power antennas, if you have more than one bay, what they do is your coax actually plugs into a power splitter box, which then divides up the power in two ways or three ways or four ways and splits it out to the various bays. And so the power splitter box costs about as much as another bay. So if you had a two-bay...
Let me show you.
A two-bay flying V, you might spend, let's say, $2,100 thereabout.
Here's something you'll see a lot of around. This
yeah.
is often used for taxicab communication.
This is a vertical only.
It's a vertical only, single-bay dipole. You probably not want to be using this unless you have, like, everybody you care about is close by.
Okay, so hearing some engineer geek here, explain what a dipole is.
It's the simplest resonant antenna, and it really is, di means two, so there's a half, that's a full, it actually means half, but this thing is about a meter and a half long, and there's a pole there and a pole there, it's driven in the middle usually,
it's not one you want to use for FM broadcast, because it's a broadband antenna, and depending on where your frequency is, it may on the FM dial, it may perform real good for you. It may be fairly power hungry too.
Well, the main reason I wouldn't choose this is because it's vertical only.
Yes. I want to show the bays here because we call this a single bay antenna. It's a single antenna. This one happens to be called a dipole. It's not the double V.
Yeah.
And this is a picture of the same style, and there's two of them mounted on top of each other. This is called a two-bay antenna of the same kind. You see it's the same antenna, just there's two of them, and they're spaced a certain, very precise distance apart.
Can you back up about two or three all to the OMB that you had up there just a second ago?
A lot of LPFMs use this style of antenna just because it's cheap. They do work, but get the slightest amount of frost on it, and it's gone.
So it's about $350 if you get it direct from the distributor in Florida. If you buy it from somebody else, it will be marked up at least another $100.
Also, the manufacturers at least will claim that this particular antenna design tends to be more affected by the tower or pole that it's mounted on. When I say omnidirectional, it's omnidirectional in the perfect world. There's no such thing as a perfect world. The moment you mount any antenna on a pole or a tower, its pattern is mangled. Shockingly badly. Shockingly badly.
And often unpredictably.
This particular type of antenna will probably work fine on a pole. I wouldn't put it on a wide tower. The pattern will look very ugly.
Yeah, I put one of these on a wood pole, and it does fairly well.
Yeah. If you can stick with a pole or a very narrow tower, that there are, you can pay several thousand dollars and have a pattern study done if it's important. And we've done that many times. And there are some people that can do computer modeling and give you some idea of what you're going to get.
We need to move on to a transmission line.
Yeah.
Before you do that, why would I spend another... Same, spend twice, so I can get a double V for $700. If I go and get two double Bs, I have a two bay situation, but I have to pay another, so I have to pay $1,400 to get the splitter and the extra bay. Why would I want to do that?
Brings your radiation angle down, so your power goes more out to who you want to serve, and less of it goes straight up, straight down.
There would be several reasons. Well, if you have a second adjacent waiver, there's about half the second adjacent waivers relied on having more than one bay. And having more than one bay aims more of the energy towards the horizon and less up and down towards the ground.
Which also saves you electricity, by the
yes,
way.
Yes. If you use two bays, your transmitter only needs to be half as big. Your electricity costs are half as much. but it uses more tower space. Two bays will allow you to get closer to people for RF radiation. If you're going to put an antenna on a roof on a 7-foot pole, you probably can't get by with a one bay. You don't have too much RF radiation for people living in the house. So there are a number of, a whole potpourri of reasons why you don't want to have more than one bay. But one bay is fine for many stations if you don't have any of these problems.
Transmission line. After that,
transmission line
up the tower.
Well, you probably should use real professional grade transmission line, which is a common brand is Andrew or Comscope, and they call it Heliax. You'll probably hear the word Heliax as being kind of a generic word for professional grade coax. You can get it as small as like 3/8 of an inch or even 1/4 inch in diameter, all the way up to 6 inches in diameter. What we would use for LPFM is usually 1/2 inch or 7/8 inch diameter cable. It's a few dollars a foot, and you have to buy special connectors for it, and it will give you an extremely good match on it. You could just use Radio Shack grade CB radio coax, but your losses in the coax are going to be much, much higher.
So you'll need a bigger transmitter.
The match to your transmitter will be poor, and it won't last as long. So I say spend a few dollars a foot. Those list prices are...
I've seen them move more than half an hour.
Yeah. Half-inch Heliax on the street, you can get it for less than $4 a foot.
Yeah, I don't know what...
There's a lot of it available.
I think those are list prices there.
They are list prices, but if you look around real carefully on the net, you can find it on the surplus market for quite a bit cheaper.
Even on eBay, there's always stuff. Look on eBay and surplus market both. As long as it's new, there's even local radio station. Ask your local radio station if they've got some slightly used coax. If it's in good shape and not cleaned up.
So how do you decide when you're going to use the Heliax with the special kit to install the connectors versus a standard copper shielded solder setup?
You probably don't have to use the special kit. You can do it by hand. It's just faster with the kit.
It does take some care to attach the connectors.
Yeah.
And they usually come with a sheet of instructions, and you need to observe those pretty closely.
I just
because people are not so familiar with this. One thing about coaxial cable is it is never as good as audio cable in terms of like moving signal over distance.
Yeah.
And so one of the principles you want to think about is you want the transmitter as close to the tower and antenna as possible, and do your traveling with the audio going into the transmitter. The transmitter will transform the audio, add some electricity, and turn it into radio, and then send it up the coaxial cable. Audio cable costs pennies per foot, whereas coaxial cable costs dollars per foot.
Yeah.
And also, even if you get the best coaxial cable, your losses are much greater over it. So you always want to have a long audio cable and a short RF cable. And I would say, I often do use, there is something between the Radio Shack grade and the Andrews, you know, like sort of LMR 9913 or something like that.
Or LMR,
Stay away from LMR.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, like if you have the headroom, between, if you have a 150-watt transmitter, you can afford to lose 20 watts going up, you know, you might save yourself a couple hundred dollars in coax for the short.
The problem with LMR cable is that it's pretty good at absorbing moisture, and it'll just, it'll mess you up real good at some point.
The Heliax will last practically forever. The new Heliax will outlive all of us. So I'd say get quality cable and never do it again.
And you shouldn't need any more than 1/2 inch if you're going a fairly short distance up your tower.
I have questions.
Should we be thinking at all about the possibility that we're going to be able to broadcast maybe at 250 watts later on? And should we pre-plan that so that we don't have to rebuy? Or
It's looking like a real long shot at this point. I would say the antenna you buy are almost always going to be able to handle that. Mm-hmm. The coax you buy will always handle that, unless you're buying really tiny coax. So, and the transmitter, I think it's a ways off. It's unlikely enough that I probably wouldn't spend the extra on the transmitter right now. That's just my opinion.
A comment on the coax there is that the bigger cable that you would have to buy for more power has less loss. And one of the reasons you don't want to use the RGA cable, I mean, RGA cable that you get in the radio shack handles power, but you lose, you might lose 3/4 of the power on the way up.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons you buy the good cable is because it has less loss. And so the less loss, more power handling capability, they come together.
I also like buying a bigger transmitter too, because sometimes over the years they'll lose, you know, 1/5, you know, but they'll still keep on running and you still have enough power. And then, of course, I'll bet you at least you've got like 4 or 5 survivalists in this crowd who are like, oh yeah, the FCC's only going to be around 5 years.
Well, like, you know, crank it up. So. Here's actually another reason. In the case of a true disaster, the FCC will readily hand out special authorities to increase your LPFM power above 100 watts. It was done around Katrina. I think some of the LPFM, there was one LPFM that was running with 1,000 watts. Is that
yeah, that's Mr. Chitton.
So if you want to be prepared for that and be able to up your power during an emergency, buy a bigger transmitter.
Some people have really interesting ideas what an emergency is.
FCC's got to agree.
If it's a true emergency, the FCC is very responsive in letting you do almost anything that you can justify.
The towers next year are mast, but I guess if you want to do a telescoping mast.
Can I just point out, since we're getting into masts and towers, because I do find in a room this size, there are also probably 4 or 5 people who are a little fuzzy on the distinction between an antenna and a tower and a mast. Anyone want to say what it is?
A tower and a mast is what you mount an antenna on.
Yeah. There's the thing that holds the thing up. You know, that's the tower or the mast. And then there's the antenna. That's the thing that the radio comes out of. Most lay people use those words interchangeably. And there's reasons for that that we will not go into.
AM, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, for your purposes, your tower or your mask is what holds it up.
I think if you look at TV, and then people get that straight.
You know,
the antenna, the mask,
there. Not on my
phone.
Were you going to talk about roof mount? I think there's how many people here might be mounting on the roof of a tower of a building? Oh my, we should show a roof mount. You have a picture of it.
Yeah. One of Tom's pictures just there.
Is it this one?
Well, I have one ready to go if we can.
Do
I don't think I ever sent you a roof mount pic.
Well, but.
No, that one that you have for Boise with the 2 bay antenna.
Okay. Oh, okay. No, that one was right there.
Oh, it's oops. It was right there.
Yeah. I just unplugged it a while ago.
Michael, I have that. It's one of the ones you gave me.
Okay.
That's the lower
there
pitch
it is.
There.
Yeah. Can you zoom in on that? Or
this
is my favorite roof mount in the world. This is made by a company called Rohn, R-O-H-N. And what it is, it's a 10-foot by 10-foot base in which you can put up to a ton and a half of concrete blocks if you really wanted to or needed to. And then you can put 2 10-foot lengths of Rohn 25G tower. Mm-hmm. So the total height above your roof is 22.5 feet, which is, and you can't go any higher and have it. And it's pre-engineered, so you don't need a structural engineer. So we've been able to use their engineering charts for wind load to satisfy the requirements of a commercial building.
They're meaning run.
Yeah.
Run.
Now the.
Because the antenna.
And so in this particular case, this was a project that Tom and I worked on in Boise, Idaho. This actually was a translator, but it's basically a 100-watt LPFM. It's a 99-watt translator. Two-bay, double V antenna, half-wavelength space. And there's some other, I think there's a received Yagi antenna about halfway down that we're receiving our station from 50 miles away over the air. And we broadcast it with perfect fidelity. And it worked out great, and we actually have done a handful of these.
Michael, I'm sorry. Did you say that needs no guy wires?
No guy wires needed. What you do is you using the charts, you calculate how much surface area of antenna that you're putting on there. You look up a chart to see what the wind zone for that area might be, like 90 mile an hour zone or whatever. And using the right conversions, it'll tell you how much weight you need to put on that base.
And 20 feet is the top. Otherwise, you would have to guy wire it, I suppose.
Well, that's in this particular arrangement. And notice that this is on a flat roof.
Right.
If
right.
you had a pitched roof, you'd want to do something altogether different.
Yeah.
You could buy a tripod mount that will go up on it that, dependent on the structural integrity of the roof itself, I mean, you got to take a look at that and see if it will support it,
right.
Even for this flat mount, right? You stack a couple of thousand pounds of concrete blocks on it, and you want to make sure the roof is going to hold.
It's got
to
be a damn
right
good roof.
Do it.
But almost any roof of a building built in the last 100 years will handle this.
If it's a flat roof.
Yes, right. If it's a flat roof.
If you've got a pitched roof and you got to say a two-story building, you might want to consider something called a bracket mount, which actually sits the tower on the ground. It goes up to the second floor. You have a bracket that's bolted to the building that holds the tower, and then you take it up further from that. And you may or may not want, depending on how you go, you might want to put guy wires on it. You do have to get clearance from an occupied floor to the point where you're not lighting up the people that are on that floor. And sometimes the FCC will put a restriction or
special condition, yeah.
Right, on your CP that you have to provide measurements that you're not radiating the people down on the floor below it.
Yeah, but in this particular case, if you use that height of tower and a two-bay antenna, even at a full 100 watts, the entire roof is safe for people to walk around on. It will be below the RF radiation standards.
It would not be with a single antenna.
With a single, you'd be right on the hairy edge. It probably would not be. Yeah. So this is kind of a nice sweet spot of an installation. If everything else in your situation will work, like the second adjacent waiver, you know, this may not be high enough to make that work, but it will make the RF radiation work. It's above people's heads.
You're not penetrating the roof, which is happy for
you. It's not penetrating the roof, so you don't have to bolt into it. There's no leaks. And you've got it pre-engineered, so you don't have to spend $3,000 on a structural engineer. So there's a lot of good things about this particular arrangement that seems to work out well.
The picture to the right of it is actually the cabinet that the engineer is mounted in there.
And then those two little piggybacks on the left side of it are two little micro air conditioners.
And keep it nice and cool.
And did you buy this new or used?
No, I got this one new.
Okay.
It ran a little over, that cabinet with the air conditioners ran a little over 6,000, I think.
Yeah. Quick question.
Yeah.
We went over the transmitters. They never really touched on the fact that I know the more bays you run, you can run a smaller transmitter.
True, yeah.
So a two-bay, would a 300-watt transmitter be overkill? Because
probably
putting out close to 300 watts, you can't do.
Yeah,
so.
But this is half wavelength space. So the gain of a single bay antenna has a gain of about 0.5 or slightly less. Two bay half wavelength space, which is what that is, has a gain of about 0.7. But you lose a little bit in your transmission line, so your gain is now down to about 0.6. So now to do 100 watts, you need like about 180 watts. So you need to buy a 250 or 300 watt transmitter. So
even for two bay.
Yeah, even for a two bay halfway. We think we all agree it's a good idea to buy a little more transmitter than you need. It can run
cooler.
It won't. You could, in many parts of the country, you might be able to get by without any air conditioning at all, as long as you're running it well below its power level maximum.
And it also improves the longevity of the transmitter if you run it less than full power.
Yeah, I prefer to run things at most at 80% of their rated power if you can do it. Ideally less than.
Although Nautel tells us that their transmitter can actually get another 50 watts out of what they claim than the 300 that it's rated at.
Is there a standard height for mass or towers above which you must guide, or is that all based on local wind speed?
It depends on the local conditions to some degree like that. It also depends on the type of tower that you get. Right? There's self-supporting towers, abbreviated as SS sometimes, that usually have no guy wires.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And that has to do with if you don't have the space to run your guy wires out, right? Then you're stuck with a self-supporting tower, which is going to cost more than a drive tower, by probably at least double.
Below about 60 feet, it's kind of a wash. Above that, clearly the guide tower is cheaper usually. But the guide tower can also be vandalized more easily, among the other disadvantages. So there's a 1,000-foot self-supporter in Atlanta. So you can
it depends on the earth conditions too, yeah. Right? What it's made out of. If you're in an area that's got real sloppy dirt and water table's only a couple of feet underneath the ground, to do a self-supporter, you're going to need a lot more of a foundation to keep the wind from blowing it over or whatever.
Typical for about a 100-foot tower for self-supporting is something like about a 20-foot by 20-foot square of concrete that's about a foot and a half deep that's buried about 4.5 feet below ground. So you got to excavate to 4.5 feet, pour a bunch of concrete, have a bunch of pillars coming out of it, and then attach the tower to that. Of course, it's a much smaller base than we generally do with a guide tower.
Places like Florida, where the water table might be a foot and a half or 2 foot below the surface, if you're going for a 100-foot tower, it might get you into having to drive pilings or something to keep it supported. A big block of concrete, the wind will take it and it will start to tilt it.
One thing about towers too is you often need a soil report from a soil engineer, a geological engineer. So don't forget. A lot of times people budget and they think about what they're going to spend on the street and the steel in the air, but they forget to budget for soil engineering and that sort of thing.
It's called a geotech report, and if your community requires that you have a permit to put your tower up, that's the first thing they're going to want to see is a geotech report before they'll even consider giving a permit. If it's required, some communities don't require a permit.
Tom, sorry to interrupt. I just want to let people know. We just found out anyone who's parked out in front here, they're going to start. We have to move cars because they're getting ready for tonight's brew and whatever thing. So if you're parked out here, you're going to want to move your car.
On the street, you mean?
Right here, yeah, right in front of the gallery and stuff. On this, they're going to be blocking this off in the next 15 minutes. So if you need to move your car like I do, you may want to do it right now.
Generally the equipment. If it's a comfortable temperature for you, it's a comfortable temperature for the transmitter. The semiconductors they use in these are usually rated at up to 50 or 55 degrees centigrade, which would be 122 degrees I've actually had a case with a large transmitter in the building where all of the air handling failed, all of it, and I arrived at the transmitter just as the transmitter turned itself off, and it was exactly 120 degrees in the building. So, but no, it's better to keep it under 80. And if it takes air conditioning to do that, then you should do it.
Can it get too cold?
Yes, it can. If it's well below freezing and the internal components are allowed to cool, when you turn it back on, and let's say it's 15 degrees outside, it may not come on. It may not come on. I heard of a case where they had to go down, back down the hill, come back up with a hair dryer, warm up the exciter so they could get it to come up and lock up. So, yeah, you want to keep the room should stay between 40 and 80, basically. In some cases you won't need air conditioning or heating to maintain that, but if you do, then you do. With a small transmitter for winter heating, well, it's only really a problem if you lose power at your transmitter, you don't have backup power, and it's off for a few hours, and it's 15 degrees outside. That's when it's dangerous. For a small cabinet, just a 60-watt light bulb on a thermostat might be enough to heat it up if you get back on the air. That's been done.
and to add to that a little bit, you don't want to get down into the minus figures with it. You get down, if where you live gets down to 20 below or lower, right, that can damage the transmitter. Some of the connections will pull out of the chips and stuff like that, and then you won't be able to put it back on the air.
If the cabinet or the building has some kind of thermostatic system, you can obviously use the transmitter heat. There's always typically with these small transmitters, they're pouring out almost as much heat as they are RF. Mm-hmm. So if it's 100 watts coming out of the transmitter, you got another 100 watts in the room. And in most climates, that's enough to keep a really small room above freezing for a cabinet.
That works unless you have a power fill.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, then you're at a problem.
So remember to think, too, about the noise that's going to come from these transmitters. A lot of people, when they're first starting out, they'll make the mistake of putting the transmitter in the same room. You did this at Radio Mutiny. Radio transmitter in the same room, but they almost all have fans that are, their job is dissipating this 50% inefficient transmitter that is sending out heat into the room, and that fan will be noisy. I think I'll have a closet down the hall.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. I'd like to plug.
5 minutes.
Okay. I'd like to plug this on the Prometheus Radio website. You can just look at it. Some of what we've talked about is there, and I got to move on.
We can do the other two items that are supposed to be in this segment afterwards.
After the break?
I move some time around.
You want to wait for the SPL to do that?
No, what I mean is waiting for the antennas and use equipment. Just keep going with this.
Okay.
Oh, we only have 5 minutes. We may do some SPL after.
So, what did we want to continue with?
What you're doing right now.
For the antennas?
Whatever needs to be done in the equipment business.
Well, at this point, the only real thing we want to talk about is transient and lightning protection. I think it's all that's left at this point. You want to dive into that one, too?
Do I want to dive into that? I've spent the last 6 weeks of my life rebuilding a 600-foot master antenna system that has 9 FM stations on it. Took a major lightning hit and burned up twice. It's going to be a 2-month project to rebuild it. So lightning is very real and power bumps are very real. That's mainly what I have to say. But
and a good example here is KHOI, who took a lightning hit maybe a month and a half ago or something like that. And I went out and took a look at it, and they hadn't put the lightning protection and stuff on it, which they knew about, but they just didn't get around to doing it, right? So they ended up losing a couple of pieces of equipment and stuff, and if they would have done the lightning protection for it, they stood a good chance of not having that happen. So
get that completed before you go on there.
Briefly, with lower power transmitters, you can buy these little inline surge arrestors, which will have a little flash tube.
We'll, $60.
Yeah, we'll flash over the
cheap insurance.
Any lightning hit. Nautel is actually a great company for giving you a lot of suggestions in their manuals, and will give you these various toroidal donuts that you wind your coax through, wind your control cable through, wind your power lines through to prevent surges. There's a lot of things you can do on your own using inexpensive parts. In addition to a power line surge protector, those that can attach right to the breaker panel, those you can get for as little as about $250.
Good.
Decent ones. You can spend 10 times that, but even the $250 ones do a reasonably good job. I would say, actually, most of the good manufacturers will give you some good suggestions on that. I guess I'd say just talk to your salesman and read the manuals and do everything they tell you to do.
And does it vary by antenna type, and do they give you hints too?
Well, I think they say to do that in 8 antenna. You're talking about quarter wave stubs or 20 stubs?
I'm just talking about grounded body antennas versus a dipole. Like the double B, I think, is grounded.
Yeah, most of it. Well, eventually it gets around the ground.
Right.
All of the antennas are susceptible to some extent.
There's a psychological problem to it, which is the way we talk about it. Like, you know, when something really weird happens, it's like, wow, it's like getting struck by lightning. You know, what's the chance of that?
Yeah.
It's like zero, right?
Yeah.
Except when you're the tallest thing all around, when you put your tower on the very tallest thing, then it happens all the time. Very, very common. A lot of people get hit by lightning.
Actually, a good strategy really is to not have your antenna be the highest thing on the tower.
Yeah.
In fact, if you can get away with it, I would put your antenna just 5 feet below the top of the tower, and on top of that, put a lightning rod above that, 2 or 3 feet above that. There's even some lightning dissipators with little fingers sticking out.
Yeah.
I think those things work, actually. They tend to static dissipators.
Yeah.
Once again, talk to the salespeople about it. These are little things that just cost a couple $100 a piece. I think they actually work. But keeping, whatever you do, don't put your antenna at the very tippy top of a steel tower. Not a good idea.
You talked earlier about the antenna messing up the broadcast signal, are there obvious tricks to avoid having, the tower
for having interference with other things?
Actually,
he's talking about the
pattern
getting
distorted
by the tower.
By the tower. Mounting it on a pole will have the least amount of distortion.
And what if you have a tower and a pole on the top and the antenna, would that
That would actually work better. This particular rooftop mount one is only, about 11, 12 inches on the face, so it's relatively small amount. What is consistent is that the vertical polarization will have a null on the backside of the tower. The horizontal, it's not quite as clear. It can depend on how big the tower is and how it's mounted. But you usually want your main audience to be somewhere in that hemisphere towards the forward side, if you will, of the antenna.
We're going to show some examples in the illustrated installations in the next segment. We do have some photos of various.
But a pole mount's the best way to go,
That's isn't the antenna on the pole that sticks out this way and then the antenna's on the
pole? Yeah, it's a standoff, but that's a directional anyway.
Well, no, that's not about the antenna. I care about the pole, the standoff.
In this.
Yeah.
It's a way to do it without it going out.
Well, that was done for a different reason.
Just the rule of thumb. The rule of thumb is you think of your antenna as being inside of a bubble that's about 10 feet in all directions, which is about one wavelength. The very least that you can have inside that bubble with that antenna, the happier you're going to be in terms of distortion of your pattern and all these other things, how well it radiates. And so when you're planning your tower, like if you're renting out someone else's tower, you want to make sure you're like a good 10 feet away from other dishes, other cell phone antennas, anything like that. So when you're looking at your tower site, that's the thing to keep in mind. Think of that bubble around, you know, the top and bottom of your antenna. So if it's a two-bay antenna, you want about 10 feet above the top and about 10 feet below the bottom. So
if you have a two-bay half-wavelength antenna, what you're really asking for is 25 feet of tower space, which can be painfully expensive sometimes. So.
Okay, so I got a quick question. There's a possibility that another low-power FM is going to be mounted there.
You'll probably have intermod. Probably both will. You'll want filters. Okay. Yeah. We can talk about intermod filters if you want.
Well.
In the next session.
Yeah. Okay. Do we want to move on to FTLs or do we
got to take a break?
Yeah. Is it all right if we do it this first thing after the break?
Sure.
Okay. Let's do that. My computer says it's 103, so let's come back at 118.
318.
Excuse me. Well, mine says 103.
Well, you didn't
you know where you live.
Okay, then let's come back.
18
hours.